Welcome to The Human Way. I'm your host, Matt Havens. This is a podcast focused on people doing good by focusing on the similarities that we all share instead of what pulls us apart. At the end of the day, we're all human. So let's dive in. Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Human Way. I'm your host, Matt Havens. Thank you all for tuning in. Before I introduce our guest, I just want to remind everybody to hit the subscribe button, you know, like it, share it, download it, leave a comment, do all that type of stuff. I've really been enjoying the conversation, even some of the emails I've been getting. So I love hearing from you all. Please keep doing that. But today I am excited to welcome Mr. Wayne Mullins to the podcast. Wayne, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Matt. How are you?
I am doing fabulous. So excited to get the chance to talk with you here today. And just very briefly, let me introduce you all to Wayne in case you don't know him. But Wayne is the founder and CEO of Ugly Mug Marketing. For 20 years, he's scared multiple different companies and helped entrepreneurs do the same with theirs. He's worked with entrepreneurs through his training, through his blogs. He does workshops, and then obviously helping companies build up their companies as well. And so, you know, Wayne and I were talking a little bit beforehand, and one of the things, Wayne, I wanted to ask you to kind of start off with is, with each guest, I like to talk a little bit about some of the failures that we've had in life. And as, you know, somebody who has scaled multiple companies and done this over 20 years, I'm willing to bet that maybe there's been some failures along the way. Now I preface that by also by saying, like, I kind of want to get people to not fear the word failure, because we're gonna live and we're gonna learn through some of these things. So as somebody who has certainly, I'm sure, had some ups and downs throughout his career, is there maybe one favorite failure that you have or some sort of lesson that you could share with our listeners?
Absolutely, Matt. You know, we could spend the entire time talking about the long list of failures and going through those, but to keep it short, keep it simple. One of the failures that I'm working on overcoming right now is this sense or failure in believing certain narratives about myself that I held on to for years. So one specific example of that would be, for the longest period of time, I did not believe that I was a good leader or a good manager, or that I was, you know, I believed that I was just terrible when it came to dealing with people as it relates to managing and leading. I held on to that narrative for quite some time. And then I finally came to the realization that, you know, that narrative, that story, that belief was going to be a huge obstacle if I intended on continuing to grow my company beyond just a few people. And so I really had to lean into this belief, lean into this narrative about myself and about my ability to lead and manage people. And it doesn't mean that I'm a natural born leader or that I'm a natural born manager. I've had to lean into that weakness and learn to let go of that narrative, though, in order to make progress in those areas.
So I love it you say that too. And also, you know, I think it's also important for everybody to recognize that nobody is a natural born leader. That's not a thing. Like, no babies were born and they came out the womb like ready to do this thing. Like, my kids couldn't even put on pants. So I don't trust them to lead other people in that regard. But what was driving that sort of narrative? Was it other people? Was it something that a previous mentor or leader had said to you? Like, what, I feel like too often that's, a lot of times what happens with people is we let somebody else dictate that for us. But in your case, what was driving it?
Yeah, in hindsight, I think it was three specific things. So one would be when I was 23 years old, I started my first company and ended up, through luck, happenstance, whatever it may be, ended up hiring my brother-in-law to work for the company. And he's a great guy. But as you can imagine, when you have a relative that works for you, you're 23 years old, it creates some unique situations, you know, where when you go to correct or to try to address some things, there's all this complexity around, is he going to take it the wrong way? Is he going to interpret the wrong way? So that began the narrative. And then the second thing would be, for that same company, the second person I hired was a gentleman. He was in his 50s and an industry veteran. And here I am, a 23-year-old, having to deal with all the psychological stuff of, you know, he knows far more than I do. Can I possibly lead him, manage him, et cetera? And then the third and final one would be, with Ugly Mug specifically, Ugly Mug Marketing specifically, I had to fire our first full-time employee. And I really, really liked this guy. He'd worked for us for over a year. We were personal friends. And I ended up having to fire him, not because of anything he directly or indirectly did, but more so because I put him in a position, in a job that he wasn't fit for, he wasn't suited for. And so it was, I think, out of those three scenarios that I had built and slowly, you know, constructed this narrative that managing people, leading people was difficult and that I just wasn't good at it.
Yeah. So how was it then, you know, in taking those instances, and I think those are, you know, scenarios that happen so often to a lot of people, you know, in some of the work that I do, where I work with the generational differences, I talk a lot about how millennials and baby boomers work together. And that second situation that you just described is happening every day, where you've got newer, younger leaders that are coming in and older, more experienced people that they might be leading. And I remember the first time that I had somebody on my team that was 20 years my senior. And you do feel hesitant to say, to try to help improve their performance or give feedback, because I would go home thinking, what do I know? Like, these, they've got 20 years experience on me. They've obviously got me, you know, pegged for not knowing enough. And so, but I think you're right. There's a little bit of that confidence that we just got to know that what we're doing and what we're building is on track, and that we can be a part of that. Was there one thing that you could sort of identify that maybe helped you get unstuck from that?
No, I would say that it was really the belief or the realization that in order to go to the next level, in order to take my company to the next level and to build a team, I had to lean into that belief about myself. I had to lean into those weaknesses. And it was just out of sheer determination to go to the next level that I had to make that decision.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of feel that one, like, very similarly with my career path when I was working in corporate America. It was too easy for me at times to let other people kind of make me feel a certain way about my own abilities, instead of just trusting at times that maybe, you know, I was ready to step into this role or this level of responsibility. So if we could, let's talk a little bit about Ugly Mug Marketing, because obviously that's where you're at now. That's the company you're running right now. And I just love the name. It is a little unique. It is a little bit maybe different than what you might hear from some other marketing companies. Is there a story behind the name?
Yeah, there is, Matt. So the story is this. There's this gentleman by the name of David Ogilvy. David Ogilvy came over from Ireland, I believe, back in the 50s to America. And he lands in New York City. Rumor has it he had $40 in his pocket. And he says to himself that, I'm going to build the world's largest ad agency from right here. And within about 15 years, he had done just that. So Ogilvy and Mather was the largest ad agency in the world for years and years and years. They're still in the top 10. But David Ogilvy had a saying, and that saying was simply this: I would rather an ad that's ugly, that gets results, than one that's beautiful, that doesn't. And so the name Ugly Mug Marketing really is just to play off of that core belief, that underlying principle, in that we should not be pursuing beautiful things. We should not be pursuing awards. Instead, we should be pursuing whatever works best, even if that's something, quote unquote, ugly.
Yeah. I love that. Like, how many times have we created things or had meetings where it's not about even worrying about the results? We're just trying to make it feel like it looks good. But you know, what the most thing that's important is the results. So like, what are you seeing? What are some of the things that, that you think maybe people get caught up where they focus on the looks of something versus actually getting results?
Yeah, it happens all the time, Matt. So one perfect example is this: the best salesperson we have for our company is the competitor of the person who calls us. So an example would be, we get a restaurant that calls us and they want a new website, for example. And so we're talking with them like, you know, why did you decide to go ahead and now's the time to do a new website? And more often than not, it's because a competitor of theirs just got a new flashy, shiny, beautiful new website. And so it's so easy for us to be distracted by those things, right? I mean, Apple's brilliant at it. You know, the newest iPhone, the newest thing, it's designed so beautifully. But at the end of the day, what people want, what people are after, and what we're here to deliver are the results. What is the end result that they are after? All the other stuff is quote unquote noise.
Yeah. No, I love that. And one of the reasons too, that I was really excited to get the chance to talk with you as well, is because, so not only are you doing that from a standpoint of just, hey, let's get the noise out of the room and let's focus on results, which I think everybody could learn from, whatever industry they're in, whatever role they're in, is sometimes we have to just get the noise out of the way and focus on the results. But also you've got kind of an interesting culture that you've built there at Ugly Mug. I mean, if you guys go out and check Wayne's website, I mean, you'll see the entire team, their photos there that are big and beautiful, but also, like, I think you got some ones where they're jumping, doing, you know, like the action shots with the arms out, and, you know, the bios are different. It's not like your standard questions. I believe, Wayne, you're the superhero that you want to be is the guy that steals all the superpowers from the other superheroes, which I love. So like, tell me a little bit about, like, how did Ugly Mug start with that sort of like vibrant people first culture, or is that something that also kind of morphed as you went along?
The short answer is it morphed as we went along. But what I would say is this, that if you have a business, you have an organization or a team of people that you're leading, if you're not intentionally building a strong, solid culture, you are intentionally building a weak, anemic culture. Mm. So your default, by not choosing to be intentional about building the culture that you want, is being intentional in the opposite direction. So what's interesting about the word culture, and when most people hear the word culture, you know, they think of Google in its heyday with the napping pods and the cafeteria and the laundry service and all these other things. But what most people don't realize is when Google is winning all these awards for the best places to work, their average employee was working 65 plus hours a week. Mm-hmm. During that period. And so we confuse what's taking place. We confuse all these things, like, you know, the fully stocked kitchen with a great culture. And it's not the same thing. You know, culture really means at the root to cultivate, comes from the same Latin word, cultivate. And what that means is it has to be intentionally worked. It has to be toiled over with your hands. And, you know, when it comes to culture, you know, we're a small company, we're a self-funded company, no outside funding, et cetera. Our people, our culture is our competitive advantage.
Mm, but so, yeah, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that is the thing. That is the thing that differentiates us from everyone else. That is the thing that enables us to get results when others simply can't or won't get results.
So there's so much like beauty in what you just said there, Wayne, but I'd also argue that, like, too often organizations, they say that their people is the most important thing, but their actions don't back it up in the least. And I think that's where we get in so much trouble, because obviously, yes, our people have to be first and we have to be very, very intentional about it. Like, I am such a fan of Zappos and Tony Hsieh, and rest in peace to him, but like what they built, and they were always about people. They were about creating this environment where people want to be there. And you're right, it's intentional. If you don't make intentional acts to build that culture, then you're leaving it up to chance. And that's never going to be a successful strategy in that space.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. So, you know, I really became intentional, you know, probably 4 or 5 years ago, as it relates specifically to building what I would call a high performance, self-accountable culture. That's when I really began dealing with things and focusing on building that type of culture out, which in so many ways are counterintuitive to my natural entrepreneurial tendencies, which are, okay, you know, chase the squirrel that's running by, the next magic bullet. I've had to learn to temper those things. I love novelty. I love the next big thing. I love big ideas. I hate ritual, routine, systems, and processes. But I knew that if I wanted to build a culture that was both highly, you know, results oriented and self-accountable, I had to work on those things in myself. I had to hold myself to the same standard that I am going to hold them to.
Yeah. So, and I want to like maybe also dive into maybe some things that our listeners could use to help sort of build that type of culture specifically. One of the things that and we're on the same wavelength here, because one of the things that I teach in some of the workshops that I lead and keynotes that I deliver around this idea of culture is whether or not you actually physically create like a physical document, or you just spend time like deep in thought and really mapping this thing out, as I encourage leaders to actually write down their sort of playbook for the culture that they want to create. Because that activity of writing down, like, what do we want to be about? How do we want our people to feel while they're here? And as they're a part of our organization or our team, what are we going to do in leadership to make sure that we are living that same sort of philosophy and approach? And just sometimes that simple activity of jotting that things down, it makes people realize, oh, wow, I'm saying one thing. I'm saying I want this sort of culture. I'm saying it because, oh, I'm going to put a ping pong table in the break room, but then my actions aren't really aligning with what I'm saying. So what are some things that you've done to help build that self-accountable, that culture in your companies?
Yeah, the very first thing I would say to anybody listening is that, you know, in order to effectively lead anyone, in order to build a culture of high accountability, you have to start with the person in the mirror. Right. So every single day when I get up, the person in the mirror is going to be the most difficult person that I have to lead that day. And it's understanding that if my words and my actions don't align, if I tell a team member on my team that I'm going to have you something tomorrow morning by 9 a.m. and I don't say, you know, I'm running 15 minutes late or whatever, I have just created suspicion around, will I keep my word or not? So one of the very first things specifically as it relates to how we foster this culture is we have the conversation regularly about the difference between trust and suspicion. So it was Viktor Frankl who said that, you know, between the stimulus and the response, there's a gap. And in that gap, we have the power to choose. And the same thing applies when it comes to giving our word. From the time that we give our word till we deliver based on whatever our word was, we create this gap. There's this gap there. And in that gap, we can either fill it with trust or suspicion. And what happens is over time, when people are new to an environment, new to a culture, the default is typically trust. So if someone comes in, they join our team, we trust that they are going to do what they say they're going to do when they say they're going to do it. Over time, the litmus test becomes, do they actually do those things? And so our tendency is to begin with trust, but often it ends up in suspicion. So over time, if they don't keep their commitments, they don't keep their word, every time they then give their word going forward, we are suspicious as to whether or not they're actually going to keep that commitment or not.
And you also just, I think, keyed in on something that's also really important. I actually just kind of wrote about it for newsletter blog that we send out. But what you just also described is like starting with trust. Trust, you know, there's some people that believe that trust has to be earned. I'm kind of the opposite. I believe that trust should be implied from the get-go. And then, like you said, certainly it is possible that we might enter in some layers of suspicion in there after maybe that trust isn't verified over time or by doing what that person says they're going to do. But I think a lot of times too, especially like in leadership or in some organizations, we built up this culture where we feel like trust has to be earned. And I feel like that's such a more difficult road to build a thriving culture if every day from day one, that person's coming in, they don't even feel valued or trusted. So I love how you're kind of, you know, certainly talking about that and walking that in your own leadership path, but also starting from a place of trust.
Yeah, begin there and begin with the conversation of that. Like, we trust you. We trust that you're going to do what you say you're going to do. It's up to you to continue building that trust, right? To prove, to validate our trust that we've already placed in you. If not, you're going to be building suspicion. And that obviously has, at that point, you start building suspicion, trust then does have to be re-earned at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, along that same vein, kind of in that same conversation we have, is that we judge ourselves based on our intentions, but we judge others based on their actions. And so part of that conversation is centered around whenever I don't, like if I tell you, Matt, I'm going to have this over to you tomorrow morning by 9 a.m., but I don't get it to you by 9 a.m., you're going to judge me on the fact that I didn't send you whatever that was by 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. But my intentions were great. So for myself, I'm judging myself. My intentions were great. What Matt doesn't understand is that, you know, one of my kids were sick, and so I had to stay at home a little bit longer than normal. All these things, all these stories we tell ourselves. But here's the thing. You don't know all those stories, right? So you're judging based on the action. I'm judging myself based on the intention. So when we understand that, we understand the way that we communicate, the way that we show up to other people, the way they're going to judge us is not based on what we intended to do, but they're going to judge us based on what actually took place in that dialogue or in that exchange.
Absolutely. And also, you know, I think as the person who's doing the judging, when we're making those judgments, and you're absolutely right, based on those actions, I think that's also where as leaders or even just as, you know, family members and friends, like we have a choice to make. I have a choice of whether or not I'm going to decide that I'm going to base my perception of you on these actions, or I have the choice to say, oh, maybe something's going on with Wayne. Maybe something happened in Wayne's life that it made it so he couldn't get that to me at 9 a.m. And I've really tried to push for myself, like an area of growth is to almost at times always give people the benefit of the doubt in that situation. But it's sort of like a trained muscle that you really have to focus on.
Yeah. What I would say, and I completely agree with that. So what I'm about to say is going to sound like a disagreement, and it's not. But when it comes to building a culture that holds each other accountable, in other words, peer-to-peer accountability, self-accountable culture, what we have to understand is that, sure, we want to have a culture of grace, that we acknowledge that there may be things going on that we don't understand, and that often the stories we tell ourselves may not be true. The stories we're internalizing about that other person may not be true. However, the flip side of that conversation is this. If I were to say, I'm going to have it to you at 9 a.m. tomorrow, and I don't, and you're gracious and you say, okay, no worries, Wayne probably had something come up, that's great. But then I say, okay, sorry about that, Matt, I'm going to have it to you Wednesday, the next day, or whatever day it is, at 9 a.m. You say, okay, great, no problem. But then the next day rolls around and I don't have it to you. Your grace for me, right?
Yeah.
Drops a little bit. Like, you're not going to be willing to make that same level of exception. And so what we have to look for is we have to look for those patterns and those behaviors in others, and most importantly, in ourselves. Where are our words and our actions not aligning?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, another area I'm going to maybe shift the conversation just a little bit, but maybe related a little bit, because, you know, one of the things we're talking about here is trust is, and unfortunately it feels like there's a lot of distrust that's starting to happen in social media. And what I mean by that is just that, you know, very oftentimes we're kind of wondering if what we're seeing on there we can trust, or what somebody's intentions, or, you know, even the profiles that people are putting up on their own personal social media, like, is that really you? Is that really what you're doing? And are you really truly the happiest person in the world? But so as somebody who is obviously very involved and helps companies really build social media profiles and reach audiences and engagement, how have you seen changes or what are businesses and organizations doing to help build trust in a social media environment that maybe is a little bit distrustful at this time? I don't know if that question makes sense, but
no, it does, Matt. And it's a bit of a loaded question, because as everyone knows, and as you just stated, you know, the world of social media right now is under a lot of scrutiny. Like you said, is it real? Is it fake? Are they manipulating us with the way they feed us content, et cetera, et cetera? Here's my short answer to the question is this, that at this point, each of us, businesses, individuals, et cetera, we control what we put on our page. We control the images we upload. And so the challenge for individuals, the challenge for companies is, why not use those platforms as tools to help build up and encourage? right? Mm-hmm. So right now, if you were to go scroll through Facebook, you know, chances are good. There's going to be a lot of, you know, arguing going on. There's going to be a lot of controversy going on your feed. So one of the ways we're leaning into that is we're encouraging clients to be for others in their community. We're encouraging them to support others around them, to build up others around them. And by default, because there's so much negative energy around everything else, you will stand out from everyone else and everything else that's going on. And then one other just little, like, you know, piece of advice for people as it relates to social is this, that most people don't actually do social media. Most people do digital media. And here's what I mean by that. When we think social media, social means there's a dialogue taking place, right? Social. Instead, most people go to Facebook, to Instagram, whatever channel you choose, and they show up and they throw up, right? They show up and they broadcast their message to the world. And then when someone does actually interact with it, when they do comment back, what do? We give them the silent treatment. We don't respond. We don't acknowledge they took the time to respond. And so what I would tell you is this, that look for ways to make your social media social. Look for ways to actually engage in dialogue with people. Don't make it a platform where you show up and throw up. Don't make it a billboard. Make it a place of social interaction.
So I absolutely love that. Love that idea. And, you know, I think that's what sometimes people get a little bit too caught up. And this is probably more on the personal side than for businesses is, you know, they get caught up in what they're seeing online and the messages that they are sometimes in cases being fed without just recognizing that, you know, there's still a lot of good out there. Right. A friend of mine the other day was talking about how, you know, if you want to brighten up your day a little bit, start going and searching for rainbows and puppies every day. And, you know, if you do that every day, it's going to start showing up on your feed so that you're going to see the happiness in the world because it is out there. It's just unfortunate sometimes. So, you know, it's like our crazy relatives that are the ones posting stuff that we just, you know, maybe need to mute them for a little bit so we don't have to see it. But so how do you, I think another thing that people are challenged with in social media is because there is such a, you know, a desire for, whether it's likes or a viral moment or, you know, this sort of attention is how do you then balance that with just being genuine and being like either as an organization, who they truly are and who they want to be? Like, how do you balance that need for attention with just the genuine nature of social interaction?
Yeah, I think it goes back to defining what you're after. So Facebook, all the social media platforms, but to pick on Facebook, they're brilliant at feeding us what I would call vanity metrics. So vanity metrics being the number of times, you know, someone likes a post, the number of comments we get, you know, the number of followers we have. All of these things are vanity metrics. The question becomes, what good does it do you to have 10,000 followers if none of them ever buy from you, none of them ever engage with your organization, versus having 100 who actually buy from you or engage with your organization, et cetera. So we deceive ourselves into these vanity metrics thinking that more is better. And the reality is that better is better, right? Yep. Having people who are actually dialoguing with us, engaging with us, purchasing our products, supporting our causes, whatever those may be, that is the end goal. But until we sit down and clearly identify what are we after? Why do we do what we do? And if we do what we do on social media because the competitor's doing it, that's not a valid reason, right? You're spinning your wheels. You're confusing actions, so the actions of other people, with assets. And it happens all the time. The question becomes, what asset are you actually building? Are you turning your social media platforms into an asset, or are you just following the actions that a competitor is doing over and over again?
Yeah. Very, very well said. I think it even goes back to kind of the beginning of the conversation when we talked about like either letting somebody else tell that narrative or in this case, right, following along with what a competitor is doing versus taking ownership and thinking about it more like the asset that you want to create. You know, I think there's some similarities and some parallels there that folks could learn from.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what's so interesting about social media is that, you know, seems like every other day a new platform is born, a new place for businesses to run to, organizations to run to, you know, be on the front of the curve, to get there ahead of everyone else. And if I could tell you the amount of time, energy, and effort and dollars wasted chasing all these things, it's just mind blowing. Where instead, if we spent that same amount of time, if we spent some time stepping back and saying, what is it that I'm trying to build? And then who am I trying to connect with? Right. And then how do I go about connecting with those people? It's really that simple. It's not about being a million places to a million different people. It's about connecting and resonating with the audience that matters to you.
Oh yeah. And so there's a similar sort of thing that I'm really big on, not related to social media, but it's just about this idea of community. And I think what you just described is from the social media perspective, like what community do you want to build? What community do you want to be a part of, whether you're an organization or your personal brand, and focusing intensely on that? Because the honest truth is, it's not the 7 billion people in this world. It's a much smaller subset of the community that you want to be a part of. And I think where people kind of on the personal side probably get caught up in the social media world a little bit is they think it's everything. They think it's all 5,000 followers they have or friends on Facebook. And really, when you really drill down to it, most people's community is pretty small. It's about 100, mm-hmm. 200 people at most. And so really leaning in and focusing in on those people, because those are the people that you're going to find happiness, you're going to find success, you're going to find your lane to play in, and then grow from there versus trying to focus on all 7 billion of the people out there.
Yeah. And just to tag on to what you were just saying, Matt, is that there's a quote, I think it comes from Andy Stanley. And the quote is, do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. Mm-hmm. So do for that one person what you wish you could do for everybody else. And that's really at the heart of community. That's really what it's about. It's about meeting needs. It's about being there for them when they need you. You know, it's about shared interests, shared beliefs. So if we shift our mentality from reaching the world, broadcasting to the world, to what can I do for one that I wish I could do for everyone, that completely shifts our marketing strategies. It completely shifts our messaging. It shifts so much of what we do.
And I think too, it also shifts what we would do in our leadership, right? If we take that same approach, what can I do for this one person that I'm helping to lead or grow or develop? Well, that's going to have, you know, a much bigger impact down the road too, if I focus on this moment, this interaction, this one person. Very, very well said. I think we've got a lot of good information here that people could take from. I want to thank you, Wayne, for the time here today. Where can people find you? Where can they connect with you online or in person?
Yeah, the best place, Matt, would be to go to our website. It's just uglymugmarketing.com. My email address is there, phone number's there, all our social media channels are there. That's the simplest. I would like to just end kind of where we began with one quick thing.
Absolutely.
You started the conversation with failure, like what's a failure that I've learned a lot from. And one of the things that we do in our weekly team meeting, and we have now for probably, I'm going to guess, close to a year, is that we have to share a failure. So each of us has to list on our meeting agenda a failure that we've experienced. And one of the things, as we've talked about failure and as we've leaned into failure as an organization, I came across this work by a Harvard business professor named Amy Edmondson. And she basically ranks failure from blameworthiness to praiseworthiness. And so here's the interesting thing. You know, for the longest, we would just talk about failures in our organization. And, you know, there was no judgment. There was no, like, how dare you? How could you? Any of that. But it really got us to think, like, should we be celebrating all of these failures, or are there differing levels of failure? And so if you go Google search for Amy Edmondson, Harvard business professor on failure, you'll find this. But she basically says that there are some things, failure-wise, that are blameworthy. So when we commit these failures, we're worthy of blame. However, there are other failures that we may commit that are praiseworthy. And so for us as an organization, what we're trying to lean into is learning from the failures that are praiseworthy, avoiding the failures that are blameworthy. And so I would circle all the way back to what you originally opened with, failure, and that failure is the most powerful teacher we have, and that we should lean into failure.
I think if we embrace failure and you know, not to steal Amy's sort of ideas or words, right? But it's like, of course we want to avoid catastrophic failures of our business or our leadership teams, but if we can embrace those moments and use it to reject fear, the fear that comes with, well, if I step out and I do something new, or if I am wrong and it doesn't go well, if we embrace those moments, use it to reject fear, I think more often than not, we're going to be wildly successful and happy with the results because we were willing to push a little bit harder and try something new and learn and grow.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I greatly, greatly appreciate it. To everybody tuning in, thank you so much. Please remember, download it, like it, do all the stuff that the kids are doing, smashing like buttons. I don't really know what that is, but let's just remember at the end of the day, folks, we're all in this together. We are all human. You will find what you're looking for, whatever that may be. So let's choose to find the good. Thank you, everybody, for your time. Have a great rest of your day.